Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to... And today we're actually going to focus on the Jews of Spain again. We did originally talk about the first settlement of the Jews in Spain. However, what I'd like to do this evening is to talk about the Jews of Spain right up until the expulsion of the Jews in Spain. To focus on them, and then, please God, next week we will go on to speak about other parts of European Jewry moving eastward. We have already mentioned that in the 12th century a fanatical sect of Muslims called the Almohades conquered Spain, and they had been repelled, in fact, by Christian groups and kings, and in the year 1212 only Granada remained in control of the Muslims. By the beginning of the 13th century, most of Jewish life in Spain was under Christian rule. The big Jewish communities were in Castile, Leon, Aragon, Navarre and Portugal. The history of Spain, or the geography is rather, Navarre was sort of in the Pyrenees, in between France and Germany. Castile and Aragon were other sections. Spain was more or less sectioned off.
France and Spain, and Portugal
is still where it is today, and they were controlled by local kings. There were altogether about 100 Jewish communities in Aragon and Castile alone. Just to name some of the important cities, there were most famous Jewish communities in Toledo, in Saragossa, and in Barcelona. In fact, in Toledo itself, there were more than 12,000 Jews. The Jews excelled in being merchants, politicians, diplomats, and industry. However, that wasn't without some form of Jew hatred, particularly, as we'd mentioned, the Fourth Lateran Council, initiated by Pope Innocent III in 1215, that banned many Jews from, or in fact Jews in general, from public office. They had to wear a badge, and the ultimate purpose or aim, in fact, of the Christian Church was that of conversion. Before we actually continue to study the history of the Jews in Spain up until the expulsion, I'd like this now to look at four outstanding and great figures who made a massive contribution to Jewish thinking and writing and law before we actually go on to study about the lead up to the Inquisition. The first I'd like to talk of is a man called Rabbeinu Moshe ben Nachman, Ramban. We must never mix up the Rambam with the Ramban, two different people. And the way we do it is one of emphasis, a difference of emphasis. When we're talking about Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon, we emphasize the first part, Rambam. And when we're talking about Nachmanides, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Nachman, we say Ramban. We emphasize the end part. Now, Reb Moshe ben Nachman was born in Gerona, which is in Aragon, in the year 1194. At the age of 16, he'd already mastered the entire Talmud and wrote a commentary on it called Milchamos Hashem, the Wars of the Almighty, which is in fact an appendix to most editions of the Talmud today. He earned his living as a doctor, but he also mastered mathematics, astronomy, and philosophy. Age 20, he began his magnum opus, which was his commentary on the entire Talmud. And whilst he was writing that, he also diverged into becoming somewhat of a defending angel in the literary word. Now what I mean by that is that as works, great works, were being produced, so too were they often attacked by other great people. For example, Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, of whom was spoken of, he a critical work on the Rif was written by a man called Reb Zerachia Halevi, a work called the Baal HaMoir, and the Milchamos Hashem defends the Rif against the Baal HaMoir. The Sefer HaZchus defends the Rif against a critique written by the Ravid. A sefer called the Halachas Gedolis was defended against Rambam by the Ramban. In other words, Rambam made a critique of this book, and Ramban again defends him. So Ramban often took it upon himself, if you want, to defend great works by which were criticized, by writing another great work, sort of defending the main work. He also wrote two very important short treatises, one called the Igeres HaRamban, which is a short letter, but very important letter, elaborating on the meaning, sanctity, and significance of Jewish marriage. And in fact, that is still studied today by many chasanim and kalos, many brides and grooms before they get married. It still is a standard work today to study the Igeres HaRamban, the letter which the Ramban wrote about the greatness and the meaning of marriage. He also wrote a book called the Shar HaGmul, the Gateways of Reward, in which he touches upon the subject of Mashiach and Geula. You must realize, of course, at that time when there was great polemic and debate in between the philosophers, theologians of the Christian and the Jewish worlds, there was much talk about the Messianic era and the redemption. And in fact, in the Shar HaGmul, the Ramban differs in many issues with Rambam. We find that Rambam was a great philosopher, but a rational par excellence. The Ramban was more of a mystic. And therefore you'll find on many occasions that he quotes the Kabbalah, and he very much veers towards the Kabbalistic interpretation or opinion on certain basic philosophical issues. Perhaps what Ramban, apart from his commentary and Chidushim, his novelai on the Talmud, will most be known for, however, is his brilliant commentary on the Chumash. The Pirush HaRamban ala Chumash. Ramban has written a commentary on the Chumash, which is today even translated into English. Sometimes he will disagree with Rashi. He'll always quote Rashi, and he may disagree with him. He vigorously opposes Rambam's biblical interpretation in his Moreh Nevuchim, in his Guide to the Perplexed. Of course, I've explained that Rambam often gave rationalizations to many of the biblical laws, which were so rational and in fact were opposed by many of the great people, including the Ramban. Ramban often chose to give an esoteric meaning. He was perhaps one of the first scholars who brought the Kabbalah, the mystical dimension of Judaism, to a much wider audience. And in fact, it can be said that the rise of the study of Kabbalah in Spain was made mainly due to the influence of the Ramban. Now, we will see later that there was a tremendous renaissance and of the learning of the Kabbalah in the 16th century in Tzfas in Israel. And that was a direct result of the Girush Sefarad, of the expulsion of the Jews in Spain. And the Jews in Spain were very much into the Kabbalah, one could say, because of the influence of Ramban. Now, we find there are many similarities between the Rambam and the Ramban. Of course, the Ramban lived later than the Rambam, but there were many similarities between the two. Both, in fact, were driven out of their native land. Rambam was driven out of native land by the Almohades, by the Muslims. Ramban, as we'll soon see later, was driven out of his native Spain by the Christians. Both sought refuge in the land of Israel. Rambam, of course, didn't stay there. He only passed through the land of Israel. He moved on eventually to Fostat in Egypt. However, Ramban did move to the land of Israel and, in fact, died and is buried in the land of Israel. Both were chief rabbis. Both were supreme halachic authorities. Both prolific writers, both geniuses from their youths. And yet, as I mentioned beforehand, there is this major difference between them. Rambam is seen as the rationalist par excellence, Ramban the mystic, the Kabbalist. Having said that, in the year 1232, when there was a great controversy between the Maimonists and the anti-Maimonists, those who disagreed vehemently with Rambam's rationalist explanations of the Chumash, it's interesting that Ramban very much defended the Nesher HaGadol. He defended the great Rambam. Now, in the year 1232, the Dominican order introduced an inquisition into Aragon, of which the inquisition we'll actually speak about later, trying to convert both Jews and Muslim to Christianity. In the year 1263, a Jewish apostate called Pablo Cristiani persuaded James I, the King of Aragon, to stage a disputation where this Pablo was to prove that J.C. was in fact the Mashiach, and that would be proved, and he wanted to prove it from Talmudic source. And Ramban was summoned to Barcelona for this public debate, which would take place against Pablo Cristiani. There was a 4-day debate in which Ramban proved Pablo wrong, and he in fact, one could say, wiped the floor with him. His oratory and his presentation was magnificent. And yet, as these disputations went, unfortunately, they were foregone conclusions before they even started. Although Ramban, if you want, won the debate, the customers were still lost. The king ordered further disputations, and in fact the Pope at that time ordered censorship of the Talmud. The Ramban published an authentic account of the debate in a book called Sefer HaVikuach, the Book of the Arguments. And in fact got it ratified by the king himself. He made sure that the king agreed that this in fact was the correct debate. This is what was said, and it was, anybody who wanted to could read the book and see that in fact Ramban had correctly defended the Torah and had made a nonsense out of Pablo's words. The Dominicans were absolutely enraged when this book came out, and they leveled charges against the Ramban, charges of blasphemy. They were successful. He was banished from Spain, and at the age of 72, he set out for the land of Israel. He came and found a community in the land of Israel, a broken community. He tried to set up shuls. He wrote many letters to his to the Spanish communities, describing the squalor and describing the terrible conditions which the Jews in Israel, unfortunately, were living at that time. Interesting, according to one opinion, he sent a copy of the Zohar from Israel to Spain. Now, there is a tremendous debate as to when the Zohar surfaced in the Jewish world, because for many years it was only in manuscript form and was, for all intents and purposes, lost. We do know that such a book was written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who was a Talmudic sage and his disciples. However, it wasn't available for many years. It did turn up in Spain, and according to one opinion, it was the Ramban who in fact sent it there. It was in the land of Israel that he did complete his commentary on Chumash, which today is still, as I said beforehand, studied by Jews worldwide, the Ramban's commentary on Chumash every Shabbos. And in the age 75, only 3 years after he arrived in the land of Israel, in the year 1270, he died, and he is in fact buried in Haifa, in the city of Haifa, near another contemporary, a man called Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, whom we spoke about last week, who also defended the Jews of Paris in a disputation and was also banished and in fact ended up in the land of Israel and in fact is buried near the Ramban. So Nachmanides has his place in the annals of Jewish history, in the annals of writing, and here we see yet again Judaism producing, or the history producing, a great orator, a great scholar, who managed to defend the Jews at the time that it was needed. The Ramban, of course, had many students, and perhaps the greatest student of Ramban is the next figure whom we'll look at this evening. In the Jewish world, he's known as the Rashba. His name was Reb Shlomo ben Avraham. Resh Shin Beis Aleph, Reb Shlomo ben Avraham, Ibn Aderet. And he lived in the years 1235 to 1310. He studied under the Ramban and also under a man called Reb Yonah Migurundi. The people of the town of Barcelona recognized the genius of the Rashba and they appointed him chief rabbi of the city of Barcelona, which was a position he held for over half a century. Now this is interesting, that a person should be in a particular place and he should establish a yeshiva and he should write and be recognized as a halachic scholar and authority and be in such a place in those days for so many years was in fact something very, very great. Students flocked to him from all over the place. And he attained the title not only of the chief rabbi of Barcelona, but of the chief rabbi of Spain, of Sepharad. Opinions were sought by the Jews of Italy, the Jews of France, Germany, and the land of Israel, and he wrote thousands of responsa, what we call she'elos uteshuvois, questions and answers. And those responsa of the Rashba are still, we still have them today, I have a copy of them here in the library, and they are beautiful responsa, not just on halachic issues, but on many philosophic and issues of theology as well. It in fact became the base of later codes, particularly the Code of Jewish Law by Rabbi Yosef Cairo. As many others in his time, he needed to write words of defense against the Christians and Islams and Muslims because he was involved also in disputations where he needed to make presentations. Like his mentor Ramban, he also defended his teachers, and yet when the disputes in the Jewish world came between the traditionalists and the Maimonists. The Maimonists were people who wanted to make allegoric interpretations of the Bible. He came to the defense of tradition, and in fact Rashba was in fact a little zealous in his stand on this, in the sense that he agreed to place a ban on the study of philosophy until one was aged 25, and only then, only once one had studied the entire Talmud and all its commentaries. In other words, he was very much against Jews studying philosophy and going into all sorts of comparative philosophies before they had filled their stomachs up with the food of Judaism, and only then were they to venture outside. So in fact we find reverberations of that, I'm sure, in the Jewish world today. He wrote a very important work called Torah Sabayis, which is a collection of laws for the Jewish home, kashrus laws and the laws of Shechita, etc. That's a very important work still used today. And also, he's very famous for his Chidushim al Hashas, for his novelai on the Talmud. In fact, if you go into yeshivas today, what the students will learn, they'll learn Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, and then other Rishonim, other early commentators, such as Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rashba, and Rabbeinu Shlomo ben Aderes. So he's the second personality, a famous student of Ramban, the Rashba, whom we spoke about. I'd like to mention two others. They're two very important people because I will refer to them later when we speak about the code of Jewish law, because these two people are really the forerunners to the code of the Jewish law. The first, a contemporary of the Rashba, was a man called the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel. His name was Osher. Unlike the Rashba and the Ramban, he was in fact born in Germany in the year 1250. He studied in the town of Cologne and in fact became the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the academy in Cologne. He left Cologne to move to a town called Rottenburg, where he became a student of Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg, the Maharam of Rottenburg, who was in fact the recognized halachic authority in Germany. We'll speak about him when we come to speak more about the Jews of Germany. He in fact became a part of Rabbi Meir's staff for answering questions. Rabbis then, like rabbis now, had in fact a staff of people to answer questions. The easier questions were filtered out to the younger students. The more difficult questions were researched by older students, and so on and so forth. Questions poured into the Maharam of Rottenburg from all over Germany, and the Rosh was there, the Rabbeinu Osher was there to learn from his teacher. But because of great persecution of the Jews in Germany at that time, unfortunately the Rabbeinu Osher was forced into wandering, and he spent several years wandering through Germany into the south of France, and finally made his way into Spain. Now everything is by divine providence. Yes, we know that the persecutions were the reasons of his wandering, but de facto, what we have here is a Jew who had and was brought up in the Ashkenaz communities and ended up in the communities of Sfarad, of Spain. He made his way to the Rashba, who was, as we said beforehand, in Barcelona. And the Rashba, as soon as he met the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher, he recognized his greatness, and he wrote to many communities asking them if they would like to take such a genius on as their chief rabbi. The position of Toledo, chief rabbi of Toledo, was then vacant, and in fact Rabbeinu Osher became the chief rabbi of Toledo, a position which he occupied for 23 years. Rosh too was very much opposed to the study of secular studies, and he devoted himself wholeheartedly to the study of the Talmud. And he started writing a commentary on the Talmud, like the Rif's commentary. I mentioned to you that the Talmud is very meandering, it's very long-winded, and the Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, summarized the law of the Talmud. Well, the Rosh wrote a similar work, where he worked through the Talmud and summarized its laws. However, important in the Rosh's summary was that not only did he give the law, but he also gave the customs of both Germany and Sfarad. Because he had, and because he came from the background of Ashkenaz, and now he now was in the Sephardic communities, so he had in fact both worlds, and he put both customs down in his work. In fact, his son, whom we'll speak about in a minute, Yaakov, Rosh had in fact 8 sons, but one of them was called Yaakov, wrote a kitzur, a abridged version of the Rosh, which in fact became a standard in his time, as it sort of summarized, as you learn through the Talmud, you then could move through his, if you want, summarized laws, which allowed the student to have the law available to him. Apart from his commentary on the Talmud, where he summarizes, he codifies the law of the Talmud, he also wrote other valuable, important works. First of all, Teshuvah's Responsa. Second of all, he wrote a beautiful will, which was a great testament to his piety. This was called the Orchas Chayim Laharosh, the ways of life attributed to the Rosh. And even today, in certain yeshivas in the world, during the month of Elul, they will read out aloud a chapter of this book every single day of the month of Elul, because it's a work of great musar, of great discipline, and it teaches one how to excel in character development. The Rosh died in 1328, aged 78, and he became, if you want, the third pillar of 3 pillars. Let me just explain that. Please God, when we get to the book, the Code of the Jewish Law, written by Rabbi Yosef Cairo itself, I will point out that he based his book on the works of 3 people: the work of the Rosh, the work of the Rif, and the work of the Rambam. All 3 of them summarized the law of the Talmud. 2 of them, the Rosh and the Rif, did so in the order of the Talmud, and Rambam did it in his own system. But these 3 people became the pillars upon which the Code of the Jewish Law was written. Finally, I want to mention the Rosh's son. He had many sons, but one of his sons, Yaakov, after witnessing all the tragic atrocities in Germany, decided to dedicate his life wholeheartedly to the study of Torah. He was not interested in making his way in this world. All he wanted to do was to dedicate himself to the study and the propagation of Torah. He was poor all his life. He never wanted to engage in anything else but the study of Torah. And yet, one thing he did give us was a monumental work summarizing all halachic views to his time. And he called this book the Tur. Now, it's that book over there, the green volume, the brown volumes, which I have right at the end over there. The Arba Turim, the 4 Turim. Now, what does this word Tur mean? You'll know from the Chumash that the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, wore a breastplate. And on this breastplate were 4 rows of stones. 4 rows which had stones. There were 12 stones altogether, upon which were engraved the names of the tribes of Israel. And each row was called a tur. So the word tur, in fact, means a row. Now, the Rosh wrote a book with 4 sections in it. So he called it the 4 Turim, the 4 rows. The first section was called Oirach Chayim, the way of life. And in it, he wrote all the laws, starting from when you wake up in the morning, until going through how to get dressed, how to wash your hands, how to put on tzitzis, how to put on tefillin, how to pray, the laws of Shabbos, the laws of the festivals, the yearly cycle. That's the Oirach Chayim, the way of life. The second section was called Yoiradeya, the teaching of knowledge. In there he wrote the laws of Kashrus. The third section was Choshen Mishpat. Evan Ezer is the laws to do with marriage, divorce, the laws to do with women. And the fourth section was Choshen Mishpat, the business laws, the laws of damages, the laws of borrowing, the laws of judges, the laws of witnesses, the laws of borrowing and deposits, and so on and so forth. Now, in fact, those were the four areas in which he wrote, which was important and contemporary, which was needed and practical today. He, of course, excluded the laws of the temple and so on and so forth. And the Tur is such a valuable work because in it he summarizes the different opinions that were around till his day. Of course, in many areas he rules like his father. His father was the Rosh, and therefore he often writes, Adoni Avi HaRosh Kosav, and my father the Rosh writes, Rabbeinu Osher writes. However, he quotes the Rambam, he quotes the Rif, and he quotes his father, and that book distilled came to be known as the Tur. And we will learn later that it was Rabbi Joseph Kaira, the author of the Code of the Shulchan Aruch, who in fact took the book, the Tur, and used it as his base for the Shulchan Aruch. Also, Rabbeinu Yaakov Balaturim wrote another work, which is studied also weekly by Jews all over the world, and that is a fascinating work. He wrote a commentary on the Chumash called the Baal HaTurim. Now, the reason he called it the Baal HaTurim, because he wrote the book, the Tur, and therefore people associated his commentary on the Chumash with the Baal, the owner of the Turim. And in it, it's a fascinating work. It's based on Gematria, on the numerical value of letters. And he works through the Chumash showing the connections between different ideas, parshiyos, concepts through the study of gematria. And it's genius to think as with a man who without a calculator or without a computer could have in fact made these word searches and number searches and found such phenomenal and gives such phenomenal insight into the words and into the letters. He really highlighted for us that the text is so particular with every word and so particular with every letter, and looking at the whole thing as a numeric exercise was quite phenomenal. Today you have a beautiful art scroll edition of the Baal HaTurim where the Chumash is so beautiful. In the commentary, the English commentary, he gives to understand every nuance what the Baal HaTurim wanted and from where he drew his concepts. In it you'll often find very great mystical ideas which for sure are the influence of the Ramban. The Ramban, of course, you see his influence there because much of the mystical content of the Turim was received no doubt from the Rosh's discussions with Rashba being a disciple of Ramban. So those are the four figures I wanted to talk about tonight: the Ramban, Nachmanides, his disciple the Rashba, the famous Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, who came from Germany and settled in Spain, and his son, Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim. Now we'll go on to actually discussing the history of the Jews in Spain until the expulsion. More or less until the 13th century, tolerance reigned in Spain. But towards the end of that century, the situation deteriorated. Navarre and Aragon fell prey to anti-Semitic clerics. And really, in the 14th century, only Castile remained as a tolerant section to the Jews. However, there came along a king in Castile called King Pedro. He was called by his subjects King Pedro the Cruel One. Initially, he treated the Jews well. He appointed a Jewish doctor as the physician in his court. And he, in fact, appointed a Jewish treasurer to his cabinet. The treasurer was called Reb Shmuel ben Meir Halevi Abulafia. Abulafia is in fact a very famous Spanish family, and there are some famous rabbis who were called Abu Lafia and great Kabbalists of the Sephardic tradition. Now this Reb Shmuel Abu Lafia brought the country great wealth, and he built a magnificent shul in Toledo. However, and the king knew this, one of the real not nice jobs of the chief financier and the what do we call him in England, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is that he's got to raise taxes. Now whoever raises taxes is of course unpopular with the masses, and he became so successful perhaps at his job, bringing great wealth to the country. However, it also brought along great animosity, and that brought along its enemies. He was arrested for treason and unfortunately tortured to death. His fortune was confiscated, the shul that he built was turned into a church. In the year 1366, Pedro's half-brother, called Henry, invaded Castile, and a civil war ensued. Now, whenever a civil war ensued, it was quite obvious that the Jews were to come out always the worse off. For whoever they were to support, they were always in the wrong. In this instance, the Jews remained faithful to the king. And Henry, the attacker, of course, what did he do? He aroused the local populace to hate the Jews for their support for the king. During the 3 years of civil war, from the years 1366 to 1369, during those 3 years when this civil war raged in Castile, unfortunately the communities of Burgos, Segovia, Avila, Toledo were all plundered and destroyed. When Henry triumphed in the year 1369, all Jews were forced to wear the famous badge, and he didn't allow them to use non-Jewish names. They were only allowed to use their Jewish names. And that was a great turning point in the status of the Jews in Spain. Two main factors caused great anti-Semitism. The first one was that the masses were jealous of the ostentatious lifestyle of many wealthy Jews, of the Jewish upper classes. And second of all, there was the religious prejudice, which now was on the rise. A very tragic incident which happened, which really sent the Jews into a spiral down. And it happened like this. There was a wealthy Jew in Castile. His name was Joseph Pichon. He was the chief tax collector of King Henry. King Henry also was smart enough to appoint a Jew to be the tax collector. And unfortunately, this Joseph Pichon, in order to gain favor with the king, acted improperly towards his fellow Jews. Now this is an interesting case of where often we find Jews sidling up to the aristocracy, sidling up to the king, and denouncing their fellow co-religionists in the process. The Jews looked at this Joseph Pichon as a traitor. And in fact, the Jews accused of Joseph of embezzlement. Now when this King Henry died, and John the First took over in Spain, a bastion charged this Joseph Pichon as a traitor to the king, and a bastion condemned him to death. Now in those days, capital punishments could be enforced by a bastion. It had to be ratified by the king. However, they had the ability in Jewish circles to give capital punishment as long as the king ratified it. Now, unfortunately, what happened in this case is that the Beis Din gave passed the death sentence on this Joseph Bichon, and they asked the king to ratify it, which he did. However, they didn't identify who it was. They didn't mention to the king that this, in fact, was the finance minister. The sentence was carried out by the king's own soldiers. And when the king found out, when King John found out, he was absolutely incensed. He ordered the immediate execution of all the members of the Beis Din, and the whole Christian population of Seville was aroused absolutely in fury. The Jews from then on were told that they must attend sermons given by priests. They were prohibited to hold any office or administration in Seville. And not only that, the king made the Jews live in certain areas, and these were called Juderias. In other words, in ghettos. And this is perhaps the first time in the history of Spanish Jewry, in the golden history of Spain, that the Jews were now forced into certain areas. In the year 1391, a man called Ferrand Martinez, he was the Bishop of Seville, embarked on a campaign of inflammatory sermons against the Jews. He was such a good orator, and the mob was so incensed by what he said that they broke into the Juderias and they killed 4,000 Jews in Seville. In fact, only the Jews who agreed to convert to Christianity were spared. This carnage spread. The atrocities spread to Toledo, Valencia, Cordoba, Genoa, Barcelona, Aragon, and Mallorca. Only Granada, which was still under Muslim rule, and Portugal were spared. It's interesting, Portugal was spared because the king of Portugal had a personal doctor called Reb Moshe Navarra, who was in fact, he was his personal doctor, and he persuaded the king not to allow the crowds to kill the Jews. And the reason, or the way he managed to persuade him to do so, was he pointed out to him that in fact it was a papal edict not to convert the Jews forcibly. And the king of Portugal agreed with him. This pogrom, however, lasted for 3 months. And because of this Martinez, this Bishop of Seville, and the pogrom, that 3-month pogrom that ensued, altogether a total in 1391 of 70,000 Jews died throughout Spain. Their property and shuls were all destroyed. Many Jews fled to Portugal, which was a safe haven, Granada, as we said before, which was under Muslim rule, and North Africa. Although many converted to Catholicism to protect themselves, they hoped that perhaps after the storm had subsided, they could return. But that was not to be so, because the Catholic clergy held these people under surveillance. The truth is, they only paid lip service outwardly to their new beliefs. In secret, they kept their Judaism. These new Christians, or they were called conversos in Spanish, were suspected, quite rightly, of duplicity. And since they soon became socially, economically, and politically a prominent group, because everybody knew at the end of the day they were Jews, they aroused, therefore, again, the hatred of the masses. They were called Marranos. In fact, many people don't know, but the word Marrano, in fact, means a swine, a chazan, or a contemptible one, one to be hated. And they called them this because it was a matter of the utmost contempt that somebody should convert outwardly and yet hold inwardly Judaism just to escape from their true belief. Countless tales of heroism surround these Anusim. Anusim mean people who were forced to convert. Now, the whole situation in Spain became worse through two things. Number one were apostates who had to be worse than the Christians to prove themselves, and virulently anti-Semitic monks. Let's look at three cases. The first was a case of a man called Solomon ben Levi. He was the rabbi of the town of Burgos until he was aged 40 years old, believe it or not, and in 1391 realized that he wasn't going to get anywhere in his circumstance, and he converted to Christianity. He changed his name to Paul de Santa Maria. In order to gain favor by his new-founded peers, he wrote and spoke terribly of everything holy to Judaism. He managed to influence the authorities to such an extent that in the year 1412 it became the law of the land that all Jews were to live and conduct their affairs totally separately from non-Jews. They had to wear loose garments, they had to grow their hair long and their beards full. In fact, anybody who looked at them, they looked like mourners, they looked like outcasts. They were closed off to all professions, they were not allowed to hold any public office. In short, he didn't allow them to survive, economically or socially. Many became Marranos in order to better their lot. So in fact, two groups of Jews were growing up in Spain. One group was the authentic Jew, who were now a growing force, but highly suspected. The second case was a Dominican friar called Vincent Ferrer. It said of him that he marched through Jewish communities with a cross in one hand and a Sefer Torah in another. And he walked into many communities and he said, "Either you believe in this or in this." And obviously, if you didn't agree with him to believe in one of them, the mob was just outside to persuade you. In fact, he is credited with converting 35,000 Jews personally to Catholicism. Well, they didn't have much choice, did they? Because the choice was death. And he was canonized. He was called Saint Vincent. So if you ever hear or whatever of the Saint Vincent, this fella, he's the guy that was canonized for converting 30,000 Jews to Catholicism. There's a tremendous amount of halachic responsa written about one's attitude to anusim, to forced conversions. Now, traditionally, one could say the following. There are three occasions upon which a Jew should give up his life. These are the three cardinal sins of murder, idolatry, and immorality. Those three areas. So for example, if a person comes up to a Jew and says to him, "Kill Yankel or I'll kill you," he must let himself be killed. Why is his blood redder than Yankel's blood? Another occasion is idolatry, that if you don't bow down to the idol, I'll kill you. And the law is that if it is done publicly, then a person is commanded, it's a mitzvah saseh, it's a positive commandment, to die al kiddush Hashem, to give up one's life sanctifying God's name. question is, what happens if one doesn't? If one doesn't, one definitely has made a chilul Hashem, one has desecrated God's name. However, here the question is it true in the case of anusim, where a person not voluntarily wanted, these people just didn't have any choice? And in the main, the anusim of that time were encouraged as much as possible by the rabbinic authorities to return to their Judaism. However, some were asked to go through a reconversion process. If they were baptized, then necessarily they may have had to gone to the mikveh again in order to sort of re-enter into Judaism, to renounce their heretical beliefs which there may have been. But there certainly was a most lenient view taken of these Maranos. The problem became, as we'll soon see, that they became quite integrated into the fabric of the secular society and almost indistinguishable, as we'll soon see. The third and last case, which I'll just bring, there was another apostate, a man called Joshua Larkey. He baptized to be called Geronimo de Santa Fe. I'm not sure whether Geronimo, that's where we get his name from Geronimo, but that was his name. Jews called him the Megadeth, literally the blasphemer. He arranged, single-handedly, a one-way disputation in Tortosa in the year 1412. Now, this disputation lasted 21 months and had 69 meetings. He invited the greatest rabbinical authorities to come and dispute Christianity with him there, and the whole thing from beginning to the end was an unbelievable farce. It was a one-way disputation. Whatever the rabbis said, they were on the loser. And not only that, if they defended Judaism too much and the other side was embarrassed, all it led to was a more virulent anti-reaction. So the rabbis even had to be careful about saying the whole truth, because otherwise they would be punished from it. Unfortunately, the outcome, which was a foregone conclusion, as I said beforehand, was that in the year 1412, all Jews were forbidden to study the Talmud. Neither were they to have more than one synagogue in any town. Plus, there were also decrees that they must attend sermons given by local Dominican monks preaching about Christianity. So we can see that the situation of the Jews was almost impossible in Spain. Now let's go over to the Maranos themselves. As the 15th century progressed, these Maranos became a very influential group. One historian said that every aristocratic family of Spain had Jewish blood in it by this time. Now, these new Christians were hated by the old Christians. A monk called Alfonso de Spina thundered and wrote a volume of every single libel that was ever thought of against the Jews and printed it. He demanded an inquisition to uproot the heresies of the conversos. This rhetoric, of course, had one natural outcome, that of the pogrom. In 1465, in Toledo, 135 Maranos were killed. 1,600 houses were burned. In 1473, in Cordova, there was a three-day pogrom started by a ridiculous story that there was a Marano girl watering her flowers in an apartment building, and some of the water fell from the flower down onto a passing bishop or whatever, and fell onto his icon, and they said it was an act to a blasphemous act or whatever, and there was a pogrom. In 1474, the same happened in Segovia, and now the Maranos also felt a little hopeless, because Jews felt, whatever they did, if they remained Jews, well, they were socially and economically excluded, And if they converted, they were hated by the new, by the old Christians, and hounded by the Inquisition. So what should you do? Even conversion now was not a safe bet. But worse was yet to come. It happened in 1469 that Ferdinand, the Crown Prince of Aragon, married Isabella, the sister of Henry IV of Castile. And this marriage, as in many political marriages of the time, joined the two kingdoms of Aragon and Castile. In 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella conquered Granada, in fact, which was then held still by the Muslims, and they were in control, therefore, of most of the Spanish peninsula. Only Portugal remained independent. Now, Isabella was a fanatical Catholic. Ferdinand, her husband, was a greedy man, greedy for wealth. And you had the perfect marriage, which combined the perfect two ingredients to get rid of all the Jews in Spain. You had a fanatical Catholic, plus a man greedy for wealth. In the year 1480, an office of the Inquisition was set up in Spain with the blessing of the Pope himself. Everybody and anybody was instructed to inform on anybody with any Jewish leanings. I suppose that the modern parallel of this was the KGB in Russia, which had a phenomenal network of informers. Well, the same was in Spain. Anything suspicious which was seen by a Jew, which may have suggested that he was Jewish, was reported. If a man went out and bought a bottle of wine on Friday, then he was reported. He may have been a Jew preparing for Shabbos. The suspects were arrested. They sat in cold dungeons for months on end. They were tortured and then burnt at the stake. All their property was confiscated. These public executions which started became what was called an act of faith. It became a public spectacle. In fact, one historian recalls that it attracted more people than the bullfight. The modern, or if you could call it modern, parallel must have been the guillotining in Paris in the time of the just after the French Revolution. It was a public spectacle. A special square was set aside for the purpose. It was attended by the king and queen in holiday dress. Those who confessed to keeping Judaism in secret were led out. If they publicly confessed in front of everybody, they were given the great privilege of being strangled before being burned, and those who didn't do so were burned at the stake. The fire was lit by a prominent dignitary, and many a Jew died with the words Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad on their lips. The first public burning took place in January in the year 1481. It was of 6 men and 1 woman. Those numbers increased daily. The entire Catholic population of Spain was enlisted to search for these Maranos and to root them out. If, for example, they saw no smoke rising from a chimney on Shabbos, the head of the house was arrested. If they saw a parent blessing a child without crossing himself, then they were arrested. Now, greedy Ferdinand was delighted at all this. Isabella thought she was going straight to heaven. She was doing the most wonderful thing she could ever do in her life. And Ferdinand was having a good time because all the Jewish property was going straight into his coffers. In the year 1483, a man called Thomas de Torquemada was appointed to be the Inquisitor General for all of Spain. Now this Torquemada, in fact, was Isabella's private confessionary priest. And he rose to a position, I suppose one may compare it to that in the war of Goebbels or Himmler, second to none in power. He exerted immense influence over Ferdinand and Isabella, and his name became the symbol of unspeakable torture. Everybody was powerless before him, even the Pope, and he was really a monster. In the 18 years that he was the head, the general of the Inquisition, 10,000 people were burned at the stake, and it's estimated 97,000 people were tortured or punished in some way. Now, Torquemada, he realized one thing. You've got to realize the Inquisition was an internal thing in the Christian community. The Jews had already been put in their Juderias, they'd already been, if you want, sectioned off. This Inquisition was directed against the Maranos. But Torquemada realized, as long as there was still a Jew on Spanish soil, they could never really uproot the Maranos. It would be the Jews who would support the Maranos. It would be the authentic Jews who were used by the Maranos to teach their children. In fact, Maranos would employ Jews. I don't mean to say that the Maranos are not Jews. Maranos would employ those who were overtly Jews to come and teach their own children in private. So if you want, the source, the resource of teaching for the Maranos was the Jews themselves. He, Torquemada, therefore persuaded Ferdinand and Isabella in March 1492 to make that famous edict that in 4 months' time all the Jews of Spain were to be expelled. There was a man called Abraham Senior. He was the secular head of the Jewish community at the time, together with a famous rabbi called Don Yitzhak Abarabanel, of whom we are going to speak about next week. We won't have time this evening to speak about him, but he really needs a mention for himself to describe his life, his works, and his imprint which he has left on the Jewish world. Both of those two, by the way, he was also the finance minister of Ferdinand and Isabella, just to make things worse. Both of them went into Ferdinand and Isabella and made an amazing plea to save the Jews from expulsion from a land which they'd lived for nearly 500 years. They offered a huge bribe, 30,000 pieces of silver, which was a huge amount of money. And as they were in the room talking to Ferdinand and Isabella, Torquemada burst into the room holding a cross, and he said, "Judas sold his saviour for 30 pieces of silver. Are you going to sell him for 30,000? And his words made such an impact on Isabella in particular that they did not take any notice of Abraham Senior nor Yitzchak Abarabanel, and that edict remained in force. The Jews were told that on August the 2nd they were to leave Spain taking with them nothing except what they could carry with them, that is, except for gold and silver. In other words, just say to a person, you can go out, but you can't take any money. Well, what are you to take already? And that is what happened. On August the 2nd of that year, surprise, surprise, on the Hebrew date of Tisha B'Av, on the 9th of Av, 100,000 Jews left Spain for Portugal. Others went to Navarre, which was, as I said, between France and Spain over the Pyrenees. although in 1498 they too were expelled from there. Others went to Turkey, others went to North Africa or Naples. All in all, it's estimated about 300,000 Jews left Spain on that day. The journey was extremely dangerous. Many were robbed, many were sold as slaves, there was starvation, pestilence, death, and forced conversion. Wherever they were let in, again they had the same problems. It's interesting historically. It was on that very same day that Christopher Columbus set sail for America. Some historians say that Columbus himself was a Marano. Others say there were Maranos on the ship. The voyage definitely was financed with Jewish money, a stolen Jewish money. The instruments which were used to get to America, according to many historians, were made by a man called Rav Moshe Zakuta, who was a Jewish astronomer and great sage, or his students. And perhaps this is an eerie moment of divine influence or providence, in the sense that on the day they were expelled, that was the very same day that a safe haven for later centuries was found, because America was to prove that safe haven in a later time. The truth is, after the Spanish expelled the Jews from Spain, Spanish power declined, and it has never again attained the prominence, or regained the prominence, that it had in those years. Spain was a superpower. Today, it is one of the more impoverished nations of the European community, certainly not reckoned to be a superpower. In fact, we see this repeating itself time and time in history, that the superpowers of the world tend to be the nations which are fair to the Jews, and when they start becoming unfair, lose their power. This is a historical fact. If you have a look at it, and take the British Empire, may she rest in peace, it used to be, we used to be, a world power. The British Empire was something. India and all the rest of it. If you think about it, that one time we actually needed the British government to do something was in the period between 1933 and 1939, and it was specifically then that the entrance to Palestine was blocked. It was specifically then that the Jews needed to get in, and unfortunately the blockade was put there. And if one thinks about it, in the 20 years post-war, the British Empire declined and lost much of its prominence. The King of Portugal did allow the Jews in, but not without a price. Jews were allowed to stay in Portugal if they paid a large sum of money. The rich ones could afford it. They managed somehow or other to get the money on the other side. The poor Jews could not afford it. They stayed there for 8 months, after which, if no ship could take them to any other destination, they were sold as slaves. In 1495, a new king came along in Portugal, king called Manuel, and he wanted to marry the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, and they told him shidduch's on if you purify Portugal from Jews. So in 1496 the Jews were given a mandate. They were given 1 year to leave. Now Manuel didn't really want to kick the Jews out. He realized their economic advantage. So what he did is he made an edict that all Jews under the age of 25 were to be forcibly converted. He hoped that by converting the children, the parents would also convert, stay as Maranos, and would in fact stay in the country and enrich it. That didn't help. In 1506, riots occurred against the Maranos, and in fact, in 1531, the Inquisition arrived in Portugal to dispel and expel the Jewish community, and the Jewish community was dissolved. And there ended, in a most tragic way, the life and history of the Jews in Spain, never in fact to recover. Today there is only a very small Jewish community in Spain, and as I said before, it no longer is a superpower, or certainly not of the prominence that it was then. In that 500 years of Spanish history, Spain initially was a safe haven, and it turned from being a safe haven to a place from where we were expelled. In that 500 years, there were produced scholars from whom today, whose works we rely upon, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Rosh, Rashba, the Tur, and all the other great scholars of whom we've mentioned, and we still yet have to talk about Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, of whom we'll mention next week. When they were expelled, America was found. The expulsion provided, as we'll soon see next week, and in subsequent weeks, the Jews and the renaissance of the Jewish communities in Israel and Turkey. And what we see is that although it was a period of great, first of great, it was very productive, it was amazingly productive in terms of scholarly works, grammar works, works of halacha, works of poetry, works of liturgy, and yet all under very, very difficult conditions. And perhaps in this era, again and again in history, is fulfilled that Talmudic dictum that the olive, when you squeeze it, the oil comes out. And this is what happened in this period again. The Jew was squeezed. And in fact, upon learning Jewish history, one is struck how to think that we survived all this. And not just survived, but produced brilliant people, scholars, works that kept Judaism alive and thriving throughout all this. Unless you can say it was an act of divine providence, where although the Jew was the underdog, although we were persecuted and hounded, miraculously, because of a promise of God, which we have in the Bible, we will never be eradicated. Many nations have risen against us, they have all disappeared. And it's amazing, perhaps this year at the Seder, and having learned all this Jewish history, when we say, "Hisham de Lavisein," and we say that the Chol Doir V'Doir, in every generation, Omdim Aleinu L'Chaleseinu, they stand against us to finish us off. What we should realize is HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzaleinu Mi'Adam, that ultimately the Jew will be redeemed, and ultimately, please God, in times when Mashiach come, all the Jews will return. It would be fascinating even to think, I'm sure there are many, I would imagine hundreds of people today who are walking around who have no idea they are Jewish. Descendants of the Maranos, even, you know, if we follow just maternal descent, there must be daughters of daughters of daughters of daughters who technically are Jewish, of Spanish descent, who have gone to South America and so on and so forth. And in fact, other historians have perhaps suggested that many people who convert to Judaism today, who knows, could have been originally of Jewish blood. As we said before, so much Jewish blood was assimilated and integrated into the fabric of Spanish society. But here ends on a very sad note, and on a very amazing day, on Tisha B'Av, again showing the divine providence in destruction, at a very sad period of history where the Jews were expelled from Spain.